The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Runes, the 2018 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2018. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Okay. It's actually 11:10, and my big goal is to have time at the end of this for you to ask any questions you might have, so I want to start right on time. This isn't one of those big ideas talks. It's not like the plenary sessions. This is a in-the-trenches brass tacks kind of a talk, and the thing that I'm happy about is I know that you're sisters and brothers in Christ, and you're in the trenches with me, and I can't wait to hear stuff you have to say, and I hope you'll bear with me and my nerves as I give you what I have to say. My name's Elizabeth Mackus. I've been teaching third grade for 5 years, but I've been teaching for 17 years in classrooms, and I homeschooled for 6 years before that, so I've done a lot of different stuff. My background is actually history and law, came sort of through the back door, probably like a lot of you. And when I was expecting my first child, I went back for a certification in early childhood ed because I knew I wanted to work with kids. I always did. And when my daughter, my third child, was in second grade, she was diagnosed with dyslexia. That was 11 years ago. And so I've spent the last 11 years learning how to teach reading in different ways, different avenues into literature, not to make it not to change the way we teach, but to make another path in for kids who learn differently, or a way to teach the thought process that our young kids need to learn to move forward in loving literature. So we're going to start with prayer, because I need it. Heavenly Father, I thank you for this time to share my passion. I ask, Lord, that you calm my heart and that you give gracious ears to this audience, that they will hear what you have for them. Through Christ our Lord, I ask it. So when I was hired 5 years ago, it was the end of the school year, and I don't know about you all, but at Rockbridge Academy, where I teach, we rent space from a church. And so everything gets packed up and shoved in, and you can't get to anything. So I didn't get to touch stuff, and I have to look and touch. I don't know about, I think that's a grammar teacher thing. So I got a shiny silver circle with all the lesson plans, which was great. But that's how I started my first year. I stuck pretty closely to those lesson plans that first year, and I did survive. But along the way, because you're teaching from lesson plans that were made by somebody else, you figure out that they don't quite fit you in certain ways, or that, hey, there might be a better way to do this, or a different way to get to these kids that I have in front of me right now. So the first year, I didn't change much. The second, that summer, I went home, and I thought about what I'd seen during the year. I'd seen a lot of, I'd seen some reading issues that I didn't expect to see because the kids come through having done a good course of phonics. And they could read most words, smaller words, common two-syllable words. But in third grade at Rockbridge, you change from the teacher reading the lesson in Bible to the students reading the lesson in Bible. And there's a very different thing in reading the Bible aloud than reading other literature. And that need to be able to step it up and read big words is where you start losing kids. Some kids can just do it like they learn to breathe. Other kids struggle. And so my theory was, if I teach this strategy to these kids who are struggling, it's only going to make the ones who can do it better and faster. It's not going to hurt them. And so my teacher partner and I thought about how we could do that. And we did that the first year. And I was reading a book, which I'm going to hold up right now. I feel like this whole talk's a book report. But that's how I get all my ideas. It's a book that I love called When Kids Can't Read, What Teachers Can Do. It's in your resources section of your outline. You don't have to write it down. And it's actually written for grades 6 through 10. But it's a book written by a teacher who wants to remediate problems in grades 6 to 10. And what I wanted was to train my kids so they don't become those kids who are in 6 to 10 and can't read well. So I took the advice of my daughter ended up going to a school for kids with dyslexia for 3 years, and one of the teachers there, whose daughter goes to Rockbridge, recommended this book to me, and it's been a great thing, and most of what I'm doing is coming from that book. And just a shameless plug for a desire to hear your side. I'll be at the, the resources room. I'm not selling any books or anything, but I'd love for you to come by and talk about any questions you might have and share any great things that you've done along the way. I'll be over there a lot today. So I read the book, and the book is so neat because it's written, I'll show you, in the cover. There's a little chart, you can't see it from where you're sitting, but it says, if a student can do these things but can't do these things, you should read these chapters. If students can do this but not this, then read those chapters. And my kind of book, you can target what you're looking for without spinning your wheels reading everything under the sun. So I read it that summer, came into the classroom determined to try to do a few things to see if it helped. Just that whole Geronimo Amen thing that they keep talking about. I decided that sounded like, I didn't know the phrase for it, but I kind of live like that. So I'll have, by the way, all these books sitting at the table. I'm not selling them. You can just come look and touch it. I always have to touch it. So personally, my belief is that teaching reading is the single most important thing that I do in my day. You could argue that the Bible class is the most important thing, that the math class is important, and that's all true, but if you can't read and read well and have a key into the door to what you're reading, then everything else is going to be a struggle. So that's why I started with reading, and I figure if God is exposing his thoughts, his mind in the word, then I want to make sure my students can read it. Also, in every educational model, if you can't read, it's going to be hard, but in classical Christian education, you've got to read at a high level. When they get to the rhetoric years and they're interacting with some big ideas and some big words written a long time ago, sorry about that, they need to be able to do it without having to think through everything they're having to do along the way. So my goal was to send them off with some tools in their tool belt for how to get into the literature that they would encounter. Some people think that there's no point teaching reading after they've learned to read. Most schools teach reading in explicitly and systematically in K through 2. At least at Rockbridge, we teach incidentally things that we see along the way. But we needed a systematic way of addressing some of the things we were seeing. So if you haven't, if you don't have the phonics stuff, that's one thing, and you can come talk to me about that. But if you have it and you're seeing mistakes, my advice to you is keep a notebook. It can even be the back of your lesson plan, and you put it in a folder at the end of the day. But keep track of the mistakes you're hearing from your students. By the end of the first month, know the ones you most need to listen to. Keep track and see if you see a pattern in the kind of mistakes they're making. I had a student who was homeschooled through second grade, came in third grade, very bright kid, ready to go. But I noticed he kept struggling with the vowel teams. He just didn't have a really strong grounding in that aspect of phonics, so we could pinpoint what it is that he had missed. I have another student this year who has a slight speech issue in articulating the F and the TH, and he would substitute in the F. And I realized that he was doing it in reading, but he was also doing it in spelling. That's a whole different ballgame, and something I needed to be able to tell his parents, because that to me meant that his articulation issues were affecting him in big ways. And that's the kind of kid you want to be able to make note of and tell his parents that you might want to have this looked at by someone who knows a lot more than I do. So incidental anecdotal evidence is useful along the way, and it'll help you so much when you come to parent conferences and you want to help those parents, and they ask you, How's my precious darling doing? You can give a good answer. The other reason you need to keep reading and teaching reading is in your outline, the beginning section. I think I've already explained it pretty well, but your goal is to put out kids in rhetoric and dialectic who can start to do the things they need to do to interact with literature at a high level. Our seventh grade class, the very first assignment that they get from our teacher's J.D. Head, and he gives them this poem, Sonnet 75 by Edmund Spenser, and the language is really tough, and the imagery is confusing, and I remember my daughter's now at Rockbridge, by the way, doing great, she's going into her senior year. She brought it home, though, and she said, what am I going to do with this? And those kids need tools to start on that, so we talked about rereading some more, and we talked about making meaning of each individual word and then thinking about how that phrase makes a picture, and eventually she got through it. But our kids coming up need those skills. So, unless we all learn how to struggle through a text when the text is tough, we'll not be prepared for all the tough texts each of us will undoubtedly face from time to time. Some texts are tough because we lack enough prior knowledge. Others are tough because the vocabulary is technical or obscure. And many are tough because the ideas are abstract or the syntax is complex. That's a quote from a different book by Kyleen Beers, but I think if you've ever set up a piece of technology based on the instruction manual, you may have encountered the fact that sometimes text is something you have to really wrestle with. And I live with an engineer, and one of my sons is a math major. And so I live with guys who kind of have to, they're great readers of technical material that makes me glaze over. But when they encounter nuanced, relational stuff and they have to dig a little deeper, they get a little lost. So my son would come home from 10th grade and he'd read the assignment and he'd go back to class already. And his teacher would start talking about stuff, and he had no idea where she had found it, because it wasn't in the writing. And he needed a way to draw inferences and find the meaning in the writing that he had. Happily, he doesn't have a learning issue, and Rockbridge did fill in those gaps. He's doing fine, but he is a math major. Bless him. One of the things that we did do the very first year was plug in a book that I have called Week by Week Phonics. It's a process of reading through big words, an attack strategy. It introduces a different kind of syllable each week. So instead of going sound by sound through a big word, you're starting to make chunks, make sense of the syllable types, like the word dictate. A closed syllable is a consonant, vowel, consonant, and it almost always has a short vowel. So if they see a word like contract, they know it's not going to be contract, it's going to be contract. If it is different, they'll hear it. The book also introduces all the other types of syllables, even up to Greek and Latin roots and suffixes and prefixes that change the meaning of words. And it does it in a way that it's like a little mini lesson that you do on Monday in reading class or in Bible. I've done it both places if I see a lot of those words. And then I give them it's a speed drill. It's just 100 words on a page, and it's really only 20 words repeated over and over that reinforce that syllable type that you're working on that week. And at home, they read it once every night, takes a minute, and the parent just signs off that they did it and records how many words per minute they read correctly. And we come in on Friday, and I time them, and they read to me at my desk, and we cheer about how much they've improved from day one to day five. And I record it in my notes to see how they're improving along with the practice during the year. And I don't grade how fast they go. I grade that they did the practice. They all improve when they practice, and it's not meaningful if you have a Speedy Gonzales to say, oh, you have 112 words per minute, you get an A+. And a slower reader who's maybe tripled the reading that they've done and give him a C because he didn't read as fast, he improved. And this isn't This isn't a right answer, wrong answer. This is a skill you're developing. And my personal belief is practice it, do what's right, and I will give you the grade that's required for that, not for the result. What it does, though, is gives me a window into what's going on with that student. I get to sit with them one-on-one and see how they do. The other nice part about the book is every 10 lessons is an assessment where there's nonsense words, and you, with nonsense words, you really see if they're able to apply what they've seen. They're not memorizing the word. They're having to figure out how to pronounce a word that they've never laid eyes on and never will again. So that's the what's after sounded out, and if you want to talk more about that, I'll be at the table. Come see me. The next thing that I realized we needed to work with is a different way of touching on vocabulary. I don't know about you, but we get lists of vocabulary words before we read a chapter in the literature. And it can be useful in that they might be able to read it better when they hit it, but they're not going to remember what those words mean if you give them 12 and then you read the chapter. So my personal bias is to not spend a lot of time on that in class. If they don't remember it, I just plug it in and we keep rolling. But I decided to choose words that had a real utility in my classroom. So we were reading in Bible the story of Gideon in Judges. And this is your last page of your handout. It's important to go backward first. It's called a word scroll. And I picked courageous because, well, two reasons. It's a fascinating concept in the Bible to talk about courage, especially with Gideon, who was hiding in a wine press at the time when the angel of the Lord came and said, "You're going to lead your people." So we filled it out in Bible, and I gave you a sample of how we filled it out. The first big box is the word, and we explored the meaning of the word. Then how the suffix on the word changed the meaning that we had just learned in syllable work that O-U-S meant full of. So courage is the root, O-U-S meant full of, and it changes that noun to an adjective. Well, that's great. But then we also found out that, hey, Latin is the root, and courage is rooted in the word cor, which in Latin means heart. So really what we're talking about is full of heart. And what we've always thought of as courage before in third grade was bravery and swords. But really, there's a different meaning, and it gets to the heart. So as we're doing our synonyms and antonyms, I asked for a synonym for courage, and they all said brave. And an antonym, a lot of them wanted to say afraid, scared. And then one little girl who just learned the word timid in Latin, because timio, said timid? I said, yes, that's a great one too. Because when you're timid, you're going forth sometimes overcoming fear. It takes away that notion that you can't be afraid and be courageous, because you obviously can. You have to be more courageous when you're fighting your fear. So it opened up a conversation about that. There's two other synonyms and antonyms. Notice the box shape is different, so it sort of clues them in to what they are. And then you give examples of the people that you've encountered that represent that characteristic, and an example of who doesn't. And it was fun because we were listening to a read aloud of the Iliad, a kid's version, of course, and they had just heard about Achilles kind of pouting in his tent because his girlfriend got taken away. And so they said, Achilles. And later on, one of the kids identified Nero because he blamed the Christians for the fire in Rome, and that was not courageous. That was the opposite of courageous. So those were good ones, and it brings in, you're making connections to other subjects. We were doing a vocabulary exercise in Bible, but talking about history, and even though they didn't know yet, we were planning to use it in reading and writing. So the last big box requires a sentence, but not just any sentence. It has to be a sentence that really tells that you know what the word means. And you sixth grade teachers probably won't have to fight as hard to get that. In third grade, it requires some discussion and some modeling to really put forth a sentence that demonstrates knowledge. So I gave you some samples of what that might look like. And then we stuck that word scroll in our folder and moved on. Now we're going to move on in our outline too. Fluency and automaticity, when I timed my talk, I realized I was never going to get through it all. So I had to jettison fluency and automaticity. But please come and talk to me. I would be delighted to do it. I will tell you that there are three elements of fluency I do work on. Smooth reading, reading speed. If you read really slowly, it's hard to keep the meaning all the way through. And expression. We want our kids to be able to read like speaking. And there's a bunch of stuff we do in class to try to foster those skills. And I'd love to talk to you about them and love to hear what you're doing. So after fluency and automaticity, comes comprehension, the thing we're all here to talk about. And the quote I had for you in the outline tells you a little bit about what I'm talking about. It's students do not... Sorry. Anyway, when I began in third grade, each lesson, you can look at it, it's in your outline, I just don't have it laid right in front of me. When I began in third grade, each lesson plan followed seven laws, and it began with a review, and it gave questions to ask the students about things they'd done the day before, which is great, you're hitting back on what you've covered. And then we did our lesson, usually with stuff to introduce it, and then we would have questions at the end to assess how they did with understanding today's lesson. And then we would go on the next chapter the next day, and once a week we would do comprehension questions where they answer a bunch of questions about the work that the literary work that they're reading. And in third grade, almost all the questions are very literal on the page. You can skim through and find it, answers. And I know that the bias, a lot of times we think that kids in the grammar stage aren't ready to do any abstract thought. And that's true if they have no connection to it. Abstract stuff doesn't really work well. But if it's stuff that resonates in their real life, they can wrestle through some thoughts. And I wanted to give them a way to start thinking through those kinds of questions. Beers puts it this way. I'm most frustrated when I visit classrooms in which the teacher obviously still views comprehension as a product, not a process. I know that's what's going on when after reading exercises are limited to answering questions at the end of the story. Well, I was pretty convicted by that. That limited vision is particularly damaging to dependent readers, those kids who struggle. These students, more than any other, need activities that bring the invisible process of comprehending, that thing that's going on in my head that no one can see how I'm doing it, to a visible level. Make it so they can see how it works. Now, am I dumbing down the lesson doing that? No, I'm actually raising it up a notch. I want them to start thinking about it, not just skimming and scanning. And we still skim and scan, and we still answer questions at the literal level. But I wanted to start them off on how to do the next step. So in your outline, not your outline, your handout, your very first page says, it says, I say, and so. And that's the first strategy I tried in the comprehension realm. One day I finished, it was October, my second year of teaching, and miraculously we finished history a little bit early. I had 20 minutes of unscheduled time to work with, so I thought I could review, or I could try one of these things I've been wanting to try. Yes, ma'am. Does anyone have handouts? I'll tell you what, if you do not, I can get them for you. We had 140, but we must have exceeded my number. Yes, come to my table. Plus, I have it on my computer, so I can always email it to you. Okay. Meanwhile, you could maybe look on with another person. So we had 20 minutes at the end of the day, and I'd been wanting to talk about answering questions that require you to make an inference, because I think that's the sort of the gateway skill into reading comprehension, being able to read beyond the words on the page to find out what's going on. So I gave the kids a question, and I told them, this question isn't answered in your book. It is, but you're not going to be able to find it on page 93. We were reading On the Banks of Plum Creek, but this strategy works with any book. So I said, I wrote it on the board. The question was, were Ma and Pa Ingalls, who's read a Little House book, anybody? Okay, so Ma and Pa, were they good parents? And the kids just looked at me like, yeah. how do you know? Well, that was a little harder. I said, I'm going to give you a tool and you can figure it out. So I handed out Post-it notes. I don't know if you know about third graders, but they have a deep love of office supplies, especially the girls. So they all got a Post-it note, and their job was to go through what we'd already read and find an example of a time when Ma and Pa were good parents and just slap that Post-it note on the page so they could talk about it if they got called on. So I gave them about 10 of my precious 20 miraculous minutes. And then I called on the first child. Now, as it always works, the first answer was not really where I was wanting to go. Eddie said, when Nellie said she wouldn't wear her best dress to a country party and Ma didn't say anything, that showed she was a good parent. I said, wow, you know, that shows that she was a lovely person and very gracious, but really doesn't talk about her parenting. We need to talk about what we already know. And they totally gave me the deer in headlights look of, I said, what do you know about a good parent? Oh, well, we had read the story of Eli the priest and his two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. We'd read about their horrible sins and the fact that Eli didn't correct them and turn them away. And we'd read about Nellie and Willie Olson, who are perfectly dreadful in the book in front of their father, and he doesn't do anything to them. So we'd seen some bad parenting. I said, what do you know in your own experience that helps you know what a good parent is? Use that and find me the right answer. So here are some of the responses I got, and you can look right away. Hannah was dyslexic and struggled to read out loud well, but she gave me a great answer. She said, after Laura does wrong and admits that she's disobeyed, Pa says, but do you know what people have to do with anyone they can't trust? They have to watch him. And so the next day, Laura has to spend the whole day with Ma under her sight in the house, which Laura hated. And Hannah said, a good parent disciplines his child. Super. We didn't talk about that in the reading lesson. She just knew. The next student, who actually also has some learning challenges, Harry, said, Pa didn't buy anything for himself when they went to town, even though his boots were worn out. And then when he absolutely had to get, he didn't say absolutely, I paraphrased. When he had to get new boots, he went to town with $3, and he ended up giving it to the church because they wanted to put the bell in the steeple, and he wanted to do that. And he said he would just make do with his boots with holes. And Harry said that a good parent sacrifices for his family, and a good Christian supports the church. Didn't teach that in third grade either. Julia was one of my favorite answers because I wasn't sure where she was going with this one. It kind of felt like it wasn't a good parenting thing at all, but she supported it. She said, Laura goes to Sunday school for the first time, and she's listening to the Bible story, and she said, Laura didn't listen anymore. She knew all about Moses and the bulrushes. Even Carrie knew that, her little sister. According to Julia, Laura's parents must have read her the Bible, and a good parent teaches his child about God. Fabulous answer. That was not in the book, and I didn't teach her that. So it goes on, and you can read the other two answers. The point was that they were able to make an inference. They just had to have the step-by-step tools. So the little chart at the top, you write a question, they read it. It says is where you put the information from the book. Where do you see it? What page? What do you see? And then what do you say about that that lets you know this is the answer to the question? You combine the two things, and you give your answer. And my job was to write everything on the board and then take a picture of it with my phone at the end so I would save it. And then I put this out as an email to the parents and to the admins because I was so tickled that they did so beautifully first time out of the box. It was one of those moments where you think, yay, and you're blessed to be a teacher that day. The next thing I did was a technique called scales, which sounds kind of fishy. But really it involved a straight line. If you can draw a straight line, you can handle this one. So you draw a straight line, and we used that word scroll about courageous? Whip that back out. I said, do you remember our word scroll? Remember courageous? And you remember the opposite of courageous? Yes. So we put courageous and timid on either end of our line. I said, okay, now could you please put an X on the line where you think Laura would land? And I told them the coolest thing. There's no right answer. My answer might be different from yours. There's nothing that says it has to be 1 inch over from the middle, and that's the right answer. You have to have an opinion, but you have to look in the book, and you have to be able to tell me why you think that. Okay, so they were willing to take the risk. They all slapped an X on the line, and I called on the first child, and it was adorable girl named Priscilla, and I said, where would you put Laura on this line? And she put her way over by timid, which surprised me because I think of Laura as pretty courageous. She was whacking the bull to keep him off the roof of the dugout. She was a much less timid character than I would think. But Priscilla said, in the chapter we just read, there was a crab, and when the crab started pinching, Laura freaked out and screamed. And then a leech got on her leg, and she really wigged out, said, okay, that's fair, that's timid. But I knew there might be a different answer, so I called on a couple other kids, and most of them had her more courageous. But the point wasn't where it went on the line, it was that they were all able to support their opinion with something in the story that had them know about Laura's ability to be courageous. So the next thing I did is put Mary and Laura up there, and I said, now you've got Laura's ex, where would you put Mary? Who's more courageous or timid, Mary or Laura? Almost universally, Mary was the most timid. But we're comparing and contrasting, and they started talking about why one was more than the other. And that's a more advanced skill than just skimming through a book. And all it took was telling them that there was no right answer. There was just a way to tell me what they thought. Well, I kept track of when they said she was courageous. I jotted down the moments and used it the next week because, you know, no good exercise can be left alone. When writing time came around the next week, I asked them to write a paragraph about how courageous Laura was in Little House, and I gave them the topic sentence, and I had typed up all the answers they gave me. This wasn't about finding the answer anymore. This was about them writing their ideas down. And one of the things I think sometimes happens, especially with writing at the younger level, is we put so many skills in on top of each other that they struggle to get their ideas out. So we'd already done the analysis part. We just needed to form our ideas into sentences and get them on the page. So that's what they did, and it worked out great. And because I'm interested in their fluency levels, we did an author's chair, and they got to go up and read their they got to sit on my tall stool and read their paragraph. And that helps them with their own fluency of ideas, and they see if they wrote something that didn't make sense. So that was a success. I happened to do that on evaluation day, and my admin was in there, so I was tickled it worked. it's always important to try new things on those days. the next strategy I tried, and in her book, she uses, I don't know if anybody knows the story, The Necklace, about it's a great story, much older audience, so it's clear you can use this strategy with anything, but I stuck with Little House books just because a lot of you know those. So we chose characters, and the character gets put on the, do I have time for the, yeah, no, I don't really. In the book, she suggests introducing it with a really fun poem by Shel Silverstein, which is one of my favorite poems of all time, and I have it at the table. You can come see me, and I'll let you read it, called Sarah Cynthia Sylvia Stout Would Not Take the Garbage Out, and it's a big, long poem about this naughty girl who won't take out the trash, and eventually she meets a horrible fate, and it lists all the garbage, you know. And I asked, you're supposed to have them plug in the character and what she wants. And they all pick Sarah Cynthia Sylvia Stout. What does she want? She wants to be left alone. And what happens, that's the but. Somebody is the character, what they wanted, and then but. But what happened to keep her from getting what she wanted? Well, the garbage piled up and probably crushed her. And then the so is, how does the story resolve? Then I said, who's the other character? Well, there wasn't another character spelled out in the poem other than the narrator. And one of the kids figured out, hey, there's a narrator telling this poem. So we put in, what was the narrator's desire? Why was he telling the story? And in the end of the poem, it talks about the hour is late and children have to go to bed. They figured out this is the dad, and he's telling a story to his kids about obedience. So he wants the kids to obey. And that took us in a whole new direction into the Bible and talking about obedience. And I hadn't even planned that when we did it. This book, by the way, is not a Christian book. But it's really open-ended stuff, and it really doesn't, it won't impact your ability to use it. But it certainly didn't say, and now you're going to get to talk about Scripture. That was a bonus. So in Little House, we have the Ma and Pa Ingalls, and Laura's parents, both Ma and Pa, want a better life for their family, and Pa particularly wants an economic improvement in their life. So they're settling a claim out in the Midwest. I think Dakota's is Little House on the Prairie. I think it's Minnesota. But anyway, so they're on a claim, and he's planted a bunch of wheat, and he does a lot of thinking about what's going to happen when the wheat gets harvested and what they're going to be able to do. But then comes a swarm of grasshoppers and eats all the wheat. So what does he want? He wants an improved life. What does he get? A swarm of grasshoppers that eat all the grain on all the fields and then lay eggs in the ground, which lets them all know that the same problem's coming the next year. And then how does the story end? Well, the problem was resolved with Pa walking 300 miles to the east to the place where the grasshoppers hadn't been to harvest another farmer's crop to earn money, and then hike back. And if you remember Harry's answer, you know Pa's boots had holes in the soles. So he walked 300 miles with holes in the bottom of his boots and then had to do all that work and then walk all that way back. After you've done all the characters, and I didn't do this till the end of the school year, we actually did it with all the books we read at the very last week. I asked them, we redid the exercise, and then I said, okay, why does Pa want that? And one of the little girls said, he loves his family. Yes, this is about love. We had already done Laura and Mary. Why do Laura and Mary want to obey and do what's right? Because they love their parents. Why does Ma submit to her husband and stay out on this, keep going to claims and other places where there's not schools or where life is hard? Because she loves her family and she loves the Lord. So we decided there was this theme of love and sacrifice. That's not dumbing down the exercise. That was taking it to a whole deeper level. And we keep hearing, go deep. Well, this is how you get your foot into that door with little kids. They don't get there with jargon, telling them plot and character. And in this, you can see the characters are the somebodies. Wanted tends to be the conflict setup, but is the problem. So is the resolution in your story. And it also teaches summary. Have you ever asked a third grader to summarize a big story? The boys say, grasshoppers ate the wheat. The girls tell you everything that happened in the entire book, chapter by chapter, page by page, so that the whole thing is a retelling and no summarizing whatsoever. This is a skill builder in a lot of different areas and a really great tool to dig in and get the theme of the book. We figured out that all of our books all year long, disparate time periods, we have Sarah Plain and Tall, we have On the Banks of Plum Creek, Charlotte's Web, the best Christmas pageant ever, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Detectives in Togas, and then Homer Price. All different time periods, all different countries even, but they all had a thread in common. In Sarah Plain and Tall, the kids want a mom. Why do they want a mom? Because they want somebody to love them. Their mother has died, and they want someone to love them. We have love. Then we had a Little House on the Prairie. We already know that's about love. Best Christmas Pageant Ever is a kind of a weird one because it doesn't look very lovey-dovey. You have dreadful children who appear in church looking for snacks and end up being in the Christmas pageant, and they hear the story of Christ for the first time. And what we find out is that the love in this story is that God loved them, before they loved him. And that was a whole different aspect of love and a great conversation. Then we got to Charlotte's Web. Charlotte wants to save Wilbur. Love of a friend. Clearly a love story. Next comes Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. We have Aslan sacrificing his life for Edmund. Doesn't get any more loving than that. A redemptive love, a sacrifice that changes his life forever. The last book is Detectives and Togas. Anybody ever read that one? Set in ancient Rome, a bunch of kids. Also, a bunch of little boys. Doesn't sound like love. But it's a bunch of little boys whose friend has gotten thrown in prison in ancient Rome, which apparently was a very not good place to be. And they wanted to rescue him. And so the way they have to rescue him is to work through this mystery that's in the book. Well, why did they want to do that? Because they love their friend, and a friend loves at all times. And so they sacrifice their safety and went after salvation for their brother. Also a love story. The last book is Homer Price, and we didn't get to evaluate that, but I'm sure we would have figured out that there was love. It seems to be a theme. But we had never touched, we usually just ended a book and moved on to the next book. We never really tied a bow. And it was really neat to connect the stories and find in it this continuum of love and the different kinds of love that we had seen. And it brought up Jonathan and David. We read that in Bible. And so we have friends showing love for each other. And it just gives you a whole chance to make connections and cross over from one subject to another and not teach in isolation, which we sometimes get in the habit of doing if we don't see a connection right off the bat. And the beauty part is they were making the connections themselves. Mm-hmm. It just took some guiding questions. Well, there are more strategies in this book, lots of fabulous ones. There are some I didn't bother to explain thoroughly, and I would be delighted to show you at the table in the other room. Come see me. But I refer you to these, and I tell you that even though they take time, they don't require a ton of preparation on your part, no special equipment, and our sixth grade teacher has started doing some of them in her classroom, and they work equally well there. Remember, these were never meant for third grade in the first place. They just are a way of training the thought process that goes into loving literature and finding more in it than just the facts. Okay. 11:52, we have time for, don't we have 3 minutes to talk? Can somebody look at the schedule? I think it's 11. No, it's 12. 12:10? Yes, ma'am.
I have a question. The book that you were saying, All Strategies,
uh-huh.
I'm kind of your resources. There are two books about strategy.
Yes, Mosaic of Thought is a fabulous book written after Kyleen Beers. It's a great book. If I didn't talk to you about a strat, I'll bring up another strategy. Think alouds. You do it in class and you don't even know you're doing a think aloud. When you're reading a passage, I'm not supposed to leave the microphone. When you think aloud a passage, say the kid's reading a section of the Bible and they don't always read it fluently, so there's some confusion. You stop what you're doing and you think, I'm not sure what this meant. Let's reread that one sentence and figure out what this is talking about. That's just thinking aloud, commenting. Realizing what a good reader, you're modeling what a good reader does, they realize, hey, I didn't understand what I just read. I'm going to go back and look again. I might say, hey, this reminds me of something else. Do you remember the parable of the sower when they're throwing seeds? Well, this reminds me of that time in the New Testament. Or it might remind you of a story you read. It's your opportunity to stop what you're doing and make a connection. Sometimes it's making a prediction. We have judges, I think I told you that. So in the judges, there's a cycle that occurs. The people forget about God and what they're supposed to be doing. God gets angry with them and lets another group take them over. They cry out for salvation, and God sends a judge. And the pattern happens over and over. So when we would see it, we're reading this section, we stop and say, hey, the people forgot again. What do you think is going to happen? Another group's going to come take them over, sure enough. And then what do you think is going to happen next? The people are going to whine and cry out to God. And sure enough, that's what happens. And God sends a judge. And so it's just an opportunity to make the connection of what you've been doing through the book. But it's just a thinking out loud. in Kylene Beer's book, that's in Mosaic of Thought. In Kylene Beer's book, she calls it somebody, no, she calls it, it's Say Somethings, and I printed it out. It's available online. It's just Google Say Somethings, Kylene Beer's, and it'll pop right up. It's sentence starters, so they can start making the comments that you want them to make. Make a prediction. It has, I predict that, I bet that, I think that since this happened, then I bet the next thing that's going to be is this. It gives them a framework for getting their ideas out. So it's make a prediction, ask a question, clarify something, make a comment, or make a connection. And it's just a real simple page they can keep in their reading notebook, and you can ask a student to do that in the course of your lesson that day. I wouldn't have everybody doing it. You'll never get through the chapter. But letting one do it a day is a nice way to get it out there. And make sure you're modeling it as you go. So the book that mostly I use then is Kylene Beer's, but the other one is a wonderful book and worth your read. Yes, ma'am. ESV. Shocking, I know, but yes, they do it. There's some coaching along the way, and sometimes we'll get a passage that's all names, and I say, oh, you know, this looks rough. Why don't I take this one? And they're very happy to let me have that sentence where, you know, all the names are painful and you barely know how to pronounce it yourself, but you say it courageously and know that they don't know either. My Hebrew is lacking. Yes, ma'am. I've never had one with no phonics training. I've had some pretty weak soundings through word skills, but I coach them through it. And if it's one that I know can't do it, I'll just fill in the word when they get stuck. Because you'll get kids, you'll get different kinds of kids, ones who get to a big word and they just stop, they freeze. And you get this painful silence and you fill in the word. Later, you can coach them on how they can attack that word, but your job isn't to embarrass that kid in class. Other kids will bravely see the first few letters and say a word. If the word is contract, they might say consider. But they saw a few words, letters, and they went for a word that sort of looked like it, and it may make no sense whatsoever. Usually doesn't. And so you see a different kind of correction you have to make later. But it's all this reading out loud in class is a blessing. It helps you know where you need to go with that student. If I get one that reads it just terribly, I just reread this. I just say, ooh, that was a hard one. Let's do that one again, and I read it out loud. The important thing for this strategy stuff to work is for you to create an atmosphere where it's okay to not be perfect or make mistakes. I make mistakes, especially the first year, all the time. If I was keeping track of the mistakes in the notebook, a lot of them would have been mine. But just say, I made a mistake, and I'm really sorry. I'm going to do that again. Everybody makes mistakes. I want you to try stuff that's hard for you, and you're going to make mistakes too. And we're all in this together, and everybody screws up. Don't worry about it. Let's move on. And that's a big part of taking risks for kids. They don't want to be embarrassed. Yes, ma'am. You mean silent reading alone by themselves? I haven't really done that yet, and I ought to, but I find that the kids in class, I keep a lot of books around, and I encourage them with different kinds of books. Some kids like to look at, we study birds in science. I have tons and tons of beautiful books with pictures. They'll want to read about birds, or I have lots of nonfiction books about gladiators and stuff that appeals to maybe a kid who doesn't read well. And I just encourage them to look at it in their time. What I would suggest doing is partnering with parents. When my daughter was young, what I would do is we had a sticker system. kind of the carrot and the stick, but she had a skill that she needed to do, and the only way that I was going to make her do this really hard thing was to give her a little incentive. And I didn't buy her stuff. She could use turn in her stickers to have a friend over, or to go out for an ice cream with Dad, or to pick the movie that, so that it was probably Barbie and not what her brothers wanted to watch. That was how they would turn in. She would turn in her reward stickers. Control and power are big for a third child. Anyone else? I know you have lots of stuff you do in your class. I hope you'll come talk to me at the table. Yes, ma'am. I don't. I've never had a child say that. I've had a student say, my dad says this. And I said, you know what? That's dinner table conversation, and you should go home and talk to your dad, and maybe you guys can talk to your pastor if you have more questions. This is what I understand, and I'm open to you talking to your own parents about that. You're very welcome. That, I know, happens much more in later years. Thankfully, I'm less hit with that. I'm more of the avoiding things like circumcision discussions and Tamar and Amnon and all that. Yes, ma'am. It depends on the book. But no, I don't like to stop the chapter as much as possible. I like to get through it, except to if there's a word we don't understand or can't read. The processing of it I like to do separately after they've read it. Because, or if it's the word scroll, you can do it as an introduction. But I think that the best way to kill a story is to break it up with a whole lot of talk about not the story. It sort of sucks the magic and the joy out of the book. And I'm not a big fan of sucking magic and joy. Yes, ma'am. It wasn't per book. It was one of those, remember, I'm Geronimo-ing on learning. There wasn't a plan. I picked a book that first of all, it was the word that she used in the book, which made it ever so much easier to try. But I knew it applied to a lot of things in history and in my literature and in my Bible lesson. So I knew I was going to get a lot of bang for my buck. We didn't do it for each book, and I wouldn't do it for a whole lot of words because it takes almost a whole lesson to go through one. You want to pick one that really gets you some mileage. Yes, ma'am. Our chunk is 45 minutes each day. And usually if it's I'll stop. If we can't get through a chapter, I will stop in the middle. We try to get through a chapter a day. Some books are longer and shorter. Sarah Plain and Tall, sometimes you can knock out two chapters. It just depends. And sometimes you have some really slow-pokey readers that might take a little longer. Yes, also.
Do you self-assign any of that reading
at home? No. No, the reading at home is their own choice, and I don't mind them bringing in a book of their own to read during their free time if they finish early or whatever. If there's something they love and they're reading it, then one little girl was on a Roald Dahl kick. We listened to, and I used to think of this as a little bit of a curse, but now I think of it as a blessing. We don't have a lunchroom or any way to separate from our children during lunch. So they sit in my classroom and I eat my lunch and they eat their lunch. So I play an audiobook, and I try to choose books that kind of go along with my lesson. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory has some fabulous parenting stuff going on there. Some really sad parenting, and Charlie's parents who are sacrificial and loving. But she, after she did Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, she started reading a bunch of books at home and bringing them in about by him. I encourage them to go with what they love at home. Yes? Yeah, we haven't done that. I know where you group them kind of according to ability. It's a conversation that we've had, and I know my own children. I don't tell on me, but one time when they were little, I had this wild idea about sending them to public school, and they went for about 2 months. And the reason I tried to do it is because they were starting a gifted and talented class, and I was a little unsure of what to do with my boys because they were pretty smart cookies. But I, this is by way of saying that they group them, and it ends up sort of tracking them. So I have a conflict of my emotions over that. You track them into these are the ones who can't read so well, these are the ones who read great, and they kind of, that difference increases as you go. So I don't know, it's always a tough one, it's a conundrum. What I like to do is coach them through their struggles to get them to read better, and that's where we are right now. That's kind of an admin question more than my level, but my personal opinion is I'm conflicted and I don't know. Come talk to me at the table. Absolutely. Yes, ma'am.
Can you do very much traditional read-comprehension questions where you're answering
the comprehension? We still do those questions. Not because I think it has to do as much with comprehension, but it helps me know if there's a kid who can't skim through a chapter and find an answer. If they come to me every time and say, I don't see it, then I start to realize this kid is really struggling with that skill of skimming through text. That can be a signal that there's an issue. Or you might have a kid who realize they cannot make a lucid sentence with a capital and an end mark, and they've been doing that since first grade. So that's a problem, and it's a red flag too. Also, and if you did, any of you go to hear Laura Tucker yesterday? You start seeing a lot of the things in those writing assignments that she was talking about where you can, she was talking about anecdotal evidence of possible learning problems. Those are the kind of assignments where you see it. So I don't think it so much tells about their comprehension, but more about their ability to make a sentence that makes sense and follow the rules of grammar. So it's an also, yes. How that looks?
I mean, how many subjects are you teaching, and how do you get 45 minutes every day?
Denise, how many subjects do I teach my admins in the back in a day? I know a lot, at least 6, and then we have specials, music, art, PE, those glory days. No, 2 days of history, two of history, two of science, and one of writing, where we have a whole hour for those subjects twice a week. Because otherwise you end up having 15 minutes of something and you just start to get into it and it goes away.
So then you do grammar every day?
We do grammar also twice a week, and then a time when they do that, we do Shirley.
Yeah.
So I'll introduce the lesson for 15 minutes. We do some sentences. We do some more sentences another day, and then they get the worksheet and they work at it at their desk as an independent activity for about a half hour. And I borrow time liberally from other subjects if it's something that I can get an overlap out of. I've learned that the best way to make more time is to find a connection and make good use of it. I do get a little jealous of the Latin teacher because she gets 45 minutes too. Anything else that I can help with? Please come talk to me if you haven't thought it through and you want to come talk to me privately. I would love it.